Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the recovery from Hurricane Helene continues in the mountains amidst a deluge of mis and disinformation. We look at those recovery efforts, the progress being made. Here's some personal accounts of the storm and its aftermath, and words of public officials who know the truth about the help that has arrived and continues to arrive in hurricane-stricken areas. With Election Day just a few weeks away and with early voting beginning next week, we learn about efforts to make sure people in Western North Carolina can cast their votes. The drama over a regional transit summit continues, with Charlotte officials split on whether to participate. And three major musicians announce a concert in Charlotte to support hurricane victims and the recovery efforts in our mountains. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Good morning, everybody. Welcome.
Good morning.
So, although the job of cleaning up the devastation caused by Hurricane Helene in western North Carolina is enormous, it is underway. And on Tuesday, Governor Roy Cooper had this update on the work being done to get supplies to the more difficult areas.
We are checking on every report that we get. There are soldiers and National Guard and emergency management people going door to door, working to try to find people when there is a report that they have not gotten a communication. But that number has dwindled significantly, and we hope to give you that number very soon.
He was talking on Tuesday. Do we have that number yet? Do we know how things have improved since Tuesday? Have they improved since Tuesday? Mary, I think you were involved in all of this.
Yes, I was up in the area last week, and I think you've certainly seen an increasing number of responders, both from the federal, state, and local level. And again, now that they've been able to really get sort of a foothold in the more populated areas, starting to branch out into the less populated areas that are often very difficult to get to right now, just because of the sheer amount of damage to roads.
FEMA is on the ground. The National Guard has been deployed. Other government and volunteer organizations are working on recovery efforts. It is going to take a lot of time. That's the enemy there, I think, time, because people are going to get very frustrated if they aren't already. But are they making headway? Can you tell by being there that things are improving?
I think so. I arrived a few days after the storm and was frankly pleasantly surprised in Asheville proper about how easily, for example, I was able to get cell phone service, get internet access. That being said, there are still plenty of people without power. And I think the biggest utility issue right now is water. Numerous public water systems in the region, including the city of Asheville's system, which serves Asheville, much of Buncombe County and the surrounding areas, are still down. Crews are working around the clock to get that back online, but it's a process that's likely to take weeks, not days. And public officials said this week that those crews are frankly trying to do work that would normally take months or even a year within a matter of weeks in order to get people back on clean running water.
I'm going to talk about water, but the cell phone service seemed to be a critical part of the puzzle that was hindering recovery efforts and even search efforts, because if you don't have communications, you don't know in some of these very difficult to reach places what the situation is. And the mayor of Canton, Zeb Smathers, was highly critical of the fact that they lost cell phone service in the 21st century. He said that's not acceptable. It's disgraceful, etc. You just mentioned that things seem to be improving with regard to cell systems. Is that because AT&T and Verizon and other cell phone providers are doing their jobs in restoring that service? Is it because of Starlink from FEMA and Starlink from Elon Musk?
I think it's a bit of both. I think you've seen the Starlink system deployed in some areas. You've also seen crews from the major cell phone providers going out and trying to restore towers, bringing in sort of temporary trucks that can provide service. Because, like you said, it's vital. I was out with a Duke Energy crew and talking to some of the linemen, and they said that was a really big obstacle in the first couple of days. We had all these power crews coming from as far away as Canada to help. But these people don't know the area and they couldn't get a GPS to work and they couldn't contact the more local power crews to get simple directions. So you had a lot of wires getting crossed. So they told me that things had really gotten better just in the 3 or 4 days since the storm had hit and that it was making a big difference in their ability to deploy crews to get people's lights back on.
Earlier this week, President Biden ordered another 500 active duty troops to the state to help with recovery efforts. That brought the total, I think, of active duty troops to 1,500 plus members of the National Guard. How many of those personnel are involved? Do we know?
I'm not sure of the
Okay.
exact number. As you mentioned, more and more crews have been deployed out to the West. But yeah, I think it really just kind of depends on where you are. And I think that's been a lot of the message from officials to residents. You know, if you don't necessarily see, you know, uniformed officers walking around your neighborhood, that doesn't mean they're not in your area. They might just be in a different part of town. But I think, you know, people are very eager to see that presence. They would find it comforting to be able to look out their windows, to walk down their street, to go into town and really see these officials and the military on the ground doing these efforts. But a problem has been, you know, just in terms of perception that sometimes they're just not necessarily as visible as residents would like. They're doing more work behind the scenes. They may not be as easy to spot.
Steve, we have these two disasters. We have the Milton disaster that happened earlier this week in Florida. We have the Hurricane Helene disaster. We have other disasters that have taken place around the country, many of them connected to climate change. And all of this recovery takes money. Allegedly, FEMA is running short on money. The Small Business Administration, which helps small businesses recover from these situations, also running low on money. And Congress is not in session. And Joe Biden has asked Congress to come back, and they seem reluctant to do so because all of them are campaigning for re-election. Is that a political faux pas when you have a tragedy like this to not spend, I don't know, 24 hours to go back to D.C. and vote?
I think you could, Mike, you could certainly make that case that it's the number one priority in much of the country right now, or arguably the entire country. I don't know if we've seen a point yet where FEMA just, you know, I think FEMA has said that long term, they do not have the resources to cope with these two storms. Now, is there a point at which money will be running out in the near term? I'm not sure of that, but I imagine there is time for more money to be put into the system before the end of the year, or and maybe after the election. In Raleigh, the General Assembly passed. They voted this week unanimously, no votes to spend. That was, I believe, about $273 million on disaster aid for North Carolina.
And
Some of that will be
that's just
going.
the starting figure, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, they have said
Yeah.
there will be much more.
Has the governor signed that? Because obviously it was passed unanimously in both houses. Did the governor sign it yet?
I am not certain if he has. He certainly will. I am not sure if that
Right.
has been signed yet as of this day.
Mary
Well, he
Curtis.
signed it yesterday.
Okay, Mary Curtis.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Also, it's difficult to be on the same page about disaster relief in the case of Helene or any disaster relief from the federal government when you have the different parties and different politicians out on the road spinning totally different narratives about what is and what is not being done. So you
Right.
see each politician framing it in a certain way. I mean, we even had J.D. Vance was in Greensboro, I believe, yesterday, talk Thursday, talking about it and saying pretty much that the federal government wasn't doing anything and the money was going to undocumented immigrants, which is not true.
It's a
But
lie.
so
It's a lie, Mary. It's a lie.
that, yeah.
Period.
So,
Full stop.
but I'm just saying it's so hard to be on the same page when people are saying, well, the federal government isn't doing anything. They don't have any money. They're broke because they gave it to undocumented immigrants. And then you have other folks saying, no, they're here. They're on the ground. And it's really, actually, it's it's confused and messed up the response to it, because you hear have some people not even asking for the aid that's there from FEMA because they've heard things such as if you ask for aid from FEMA, they're going to confiscate your property. And usually you see during a time of a disaster like this, everybody coming together and saying, okay, we all need to be on the same page, but this is not the case.
So getting back to the money, a lot of the money is earmarked to help local governments apply for and match federal funds, which they have to match the recovery money, and also to allow teachers and school employees in those stricken areas to be paid during any storm-related closure. It would also give schools in that area flexibility to amend their calendars and waive up to 20 missed instructional days, and to establish remote learning. Are all of the schools in Western North Carolina closed, or just those in the most stricken areas? Mary, do you know? Mary Ramsey?
I believe some systems have been able to slowly reopen. I know two of the biggest systems, City of Asheville Schools and Buncombe County Schools, both said this week that they are trying to launch some sort of day programs at some of their buildings that do have power and water, but water remains a big obstacle to opening fully. The City of Asheville is actually digging wells on their school properties right now in order to establish a water source. And Buncombe County Schools noted that they are actively working on trying to bring in things like porta potties so that they can get some schools back online. So the target date for City of Asheville schools to reopen that they gave this week is late October.
Wow.
That we're still a few weeks away from getting those kids back in classrooms, which obviously will complicate things and in terms to being able to get a full instructional year in for those students.
So many of the schools in the areas hardest hit by Helene pivoted from education to helping members of the community, providing food and shelter and support. Caldwell County Public Schools reopened this week, but in the aftermath of the storm, it had been a place where kids under 18 could grab hot meals and families could charge their devices because so many people don't have power. Even though the cell service is up, if your cell phone's dead, then you're not going to be able to use it, obviously. A place to access Wi-Fi in these schools and social services and counselors and nurses. And Don Phipps, who is the superintendent of Caldwell County Schools, he says it was heartwarming to watch teachers and community members working together to provide that needed help.
The question was never, should we do that? It was how quickly could we do it? We had to make sure that we could account for the food that we had, the food we had to discard, and then which schools could we open up a cafeteria where we had enough food, or we could move it from a freezer that had generator backup and get it all planned.
So that just passed bill that you spoke about, Steve, named the Disaster Recovery Act of 2024, it's not only money, it passed unanimously, and it also establishes a moratorium on construction fees. It provides flexibility on water and wastewater infrastructure, which I guess means they can cut some corners as they reestablish all these connections. It allows for the open burning of storm debris without a permit. It postpones late dates for certain state taxes, waives certain DMV fees, and more. Senate leader Phil Berger says this appropriation is just the first step. What more is are they likely to do? How much more money are they likely to appropriate? Is this going to be a blank check at some point?
You know, the state's rainy day fund is in the billions, so is that there is more money to be spent. But I have to assume that the lion's share of true recovery money is going to come from the federal government, that the bill is going to be so big that the state of North Carolina can't cover this. You know, one other piece in the bill is $5 million to help run the upcoming election. I think we'll probably talk about that a little bit later in the show. That's $5 million. And of course, early voting starts in 6 days.
And after that package passed, House Speaker Tim Moore spoke about this money augmenting the federal money and also praised people living in those areas for working together.
Folks right here standing behind me today even lost everything they had, lost homes, you name it. And I saw these men and these women, not just these, but folks throughout Western North Carolina who had so much lost themselves, stepping up and helping their neighbors.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE in Hickory. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Steve Harrison is here, our WFAE political reporter. Mary C. Curtis, columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Just before the break, we heard House Speaker Tim Moore praising the efforts of community members in helping each other, neighbors helping neighbors. There's been a lot of mis- and disinformation about the amount of help coming from the federal government and state sources, all of which is a lie, because it is coming. There are people on the ground doing the best that they can. But it is going to boil down to what people think in those stricken areas. Mary, and you've been there. Do people believe, who are living there, trying to recover from this, that they are getting sufficient help?
I think in a lot of ways, like a lot of things these days, it depends on who you ask. I think there are areas that feel like they are getting adequate help, that have been able to see the presence of FEMA, of the National Guard, of state agencies in their neighborhoods, in their towns. There are also people, especially in the more remote areas, who don't see as much of a visible presence yet, and they are definitely feeling negative emotions about that, feeling potentially left behind.
Is that because roads are out and bridges are out and people can't get to them, and it's difficult to access by helicopter because you can't land because it's so wooded? Is that the problem, or is something else going on there?
In some areas, road damage is a major hindrance. We've seen people having to use helicopters, but as you mentioned, helicopters can't just land anywhere. I've seen stories about aid groups literally using horses and mules to get to certain areas and get supplies like clean water and non-perishable food to people who are stranded. So, you know, on the best of days, some of these communities can be tricky to get to in far western North Carolina. And when you add in just the amount of damage, the landslides, the flooding, the mud that is just simply piled up in places in the wake of this storm and the ensuing flooding, just is a major hindrance to some of these relief efforts.
I could be wrong about this, but I think Alex wants to chime in here. Go ahead, Alex.
I just wanted to say that FEMA started actually posting schedules to show places that they would be in each county and at what time. So if people wanted to go see them face to face and see that they exist, they could do that. I know Senator Tillis had it on X, so you can look that up.
Yeah. Mary Curtis.
And I was going to say, and to refer to what Mary Ramsey said earlier, obviously the folks who were poor, homeless, English as a second language, when it comes to times of crisis, they are really in need. And sometimes it's hardest to get to them and to give them aid.
A lot of local roads, obviously, and bridges were washed out by landslide, made impassable by flood waters. I-40 was closed for a while, and the Blue Ridge Parkway remained closed and will remain closed for the foreseeable future. I-40 East opened first, and this week, Tennessee Governor Bill Lee said his state will open one lane of I-40 in his state in both directions heading into North Carolina by the end of this week.
This particular stretch of highway is incredibly important, not only for Tennessee and for the people that come, that drive in and out of Tennessee, but it's important for North Carolina because the repairs that have to be made on the North Carolina side of I-40 will have to be delivered through Tennessee.
And he said he hoped that reopening the Tennessee portion of the interstate would jumpstart the reopening on the North Carolina side. Will it? Can it? Are conditions worse on the North Carolina side? Do we know?
Some of the roads, especially when you get out towards the Tennessee border, are still in pretty bad shape. And when it comes to roads like I-40 and I-26, just from driving back and forth myself, you can get into, you know, from Charlotte to Asheville pretty easily. Once you start trying to get further west than that, you're going to start running into some issues. I myself just, you know, in my little Honda Civic was not able to get much further than that, but I've heard from other colleagues that the roads definitely get more perilous the further west that you go. And there are some roads that are simply just washed out and are going to take time to repair. They're not safe to drive on right now. And even, you know, the interstates that have reopened, when you're driving along them, you will still see downed trees on the side of the road. You can still see, you know, how high the floodwaters got based on the water marks on the trees. So even the roads that are open, you can still see very visible signs of the storm's impact.
Mary Curtis.
Yeah, one thing, and we've seen a lot of politicking over this issue, but we haven't heard a lot of discussion on the issue of climate change and global warming, because so many people moved to that part of North Carolina as a refuge from these coastal storms. But we've seen a lot of scientists say because of the warming, that is one reason of the severity of these kinds of storms that are inland. But we still, you know, people haven't been talking about it in this election season, well, and one side clearly talks about it as a hoax.
One person has been talking, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, whose state has been hit by two major all-time high hurricanes, compared Marjorie Taylor Greene's allegation that the government created these by seeding the clouds, because she said, we can do this. Don't let them lie to you. We can and do this. He compared that theory to the theory of global warming, of climate change, and it being caused by fossil fuels. So somebody's talking about it, but incorrectly.
Yes. He also said that you can direct the storm into certain areas where people vote. It's getting a little crazy.
I was going to say there's something in the water, but there is no water, particularly in the city of Asheville. that city's water system serves both Asheville and areas of like Swannanoa and Black Mountain. And they called customers on Tuesday morning with an update on water restoration. What were they told, these customers?
So the latest on the city of Asheville water system is that they have been able to get one of their plants back in functioning. It serves about 20% of the community, mainly in South Asheville. The problem is that the other facility, it's called the North Fork facility, which serves about 80% of the system's customers, is still down. Crews had to come in and lay a new bypass line. That's the piping that literally connects the facility to the distribution lines. They completed that work yesterday, but there's still a lot that has to be done before the water system can be repressurized and turned back on. There are a lot of distribution lines that were damaged and have to be relayed. They also have to purify the water in the facility because the system got flooded out. So there's a ton of sediment, literally clay and dirt in the water right now. They have to clean out before they can put it in the system.
So this is weeks, possibly months away. How are people getting by? How are they doing laundry? How are they bathing? How are they flushing toilets, etc.? How are they doing it?
It's a major problem. The city of Asheville is distributing both potable and non-potable water. Potable water for people to use to drink and cook with, and also non-potable water for things, like you said, flushing. I heard stories of people literally going out to creeks and rivers in their neighborhoods and just getting water from that to use to flush their commodes, really just having to make do. But it's a major hindrance. It's a public health concern. Because a lot of this water that people are bringing in is likely contaminated with all sorts of nasty things. It is not safe for human consumption, but there are ways that people can go and get both potable and non-potable water, but it's a major concern and likely to remain one of the top concerns because, as you said, it's going to be a while before these systems are back online.
Of course, along with everything else, the power went out in vast areas. Hundreds of thousands of people were out of power in the initial parts of the storm. As of Tuesday, Duke Energy reports about 83,800 customers in North Carolina and 6,500 customers in South Carolina were still without power. That was on Tuesday. And the company attributed that not just to down lines, but to the fact that some of the critical power grid equipment simply no longer physically existed. It was washed away. They have restored power, I think, to about just under 3 million customers. What is the situation this morning? How much longer will these people be without power where they don't have it now?
Crews are still working. Duke Energy is in some places bringing in temporary mobile substations to try and get neighborhoods back online. I went out with a crew in the Biltmore Village area in Asheville who was installing one of those next to one of those substations that was frankly just absolutely destroyed. And the hope is that will be able to get the lights back on to people quicker rather than having to rebuild these substations, which can take months. Again, I know I sound like a broken record, but it's going to take longer in some of these more rural, remote areas that are more difficult to reach, and especially in places where there are road damage. If you think about it, power lines are often right on the side of the road. When the road is washed out, there's not an embankment anymore. Those poles were likely washed away, and it's going to be hard to find places to rebuild them and restring the power lines.
So we've been talking about recovery in weeks, maybe months. It's actually going to be years, possibly even a generation, to fully recover in some of these areas. And a lot of this is hitting those who are all hardest, who are already financially insecure. So many of the people who lost homes and cars and businesses have no flood insurance, which is a major problem. And in Asheville, there was and is a large homeless population. About 700 people there are without housing in that city. Mary Ramsey, you wrote about this and about some of these folks. How did they weather that storm? Where did they go?
Some folks were able to take shelter at emergency shelters opened by the city and the county. Some have been able to find shelter with groups that were already working in the area, like Homeward Bound and the Western Carolina Rescue Ministries, but some didn't make it. And some of those organizations that I mentioned are still keeping what they're calling lost and found lists, just writing down all of the people that they serve regularly and have not been able to find yet, that they are hoping will turn up. I spoke to the executive director of Western Carolina Rescue Ministries, which runs multiple homeless shelters in the Asheville area. He said he's especially concerned about many folks he knew who tended to camp along the Swannanoa River, which obviously flooded, and is just, you know, actively hoping and praying that some of them were able to get to higher ground safely. He said they're fielding multiple calls and messages from folks across the country who are trying to track down their relatives and friends who were unhoused in the Asheville area. So it's a pretty dire situation for that community, frankly.
You also quoted Melissa Duong. I hope I said her name correctly. She's the board president of Homeward Bound. She said the magnitude of the families and individuals who need housing will be insurmountable. That is dramatic turn of phrase.
Yes, most definitely. As you mentioned, Asheville already had a huge housing problem, a lack of affordable housing, more than 700 people experiencing homeless, a lot of other people housing insecure, that is, you know, kind of on the verge of homelessness if one or two things were to go wrong in their life. And now you have this major storm come through and wipe out so much housing. So these organizations that are just doing the Lord's work already are now scrambling to try and figure out, and it impacts their bottom line too. Western Carolina Rescue Ministries, for example, was supposed to hold their major annual fundraising gala last week and had to cancel that due to the storm. So that's a huge portion of their budget that they simply don't know how they're going to make up at a time when they've got more people to serve than ever.
Like Charlotte, they didn't have enough affordable housing in Asheville to begin with, and now they have less because a lot of it was destroyed by this flood. And you say that Western Carolina Rescue has received calls and social media messages from all over the country, from people seeking help in locating loved ones who were unhoused and living on the streets in Asheville. Are they having any luck in finding some of these people? Do you know?
They're trying. They are working with officials who are able to get out into some of these areas to do wellness checks. They are going out and doing wellness checks themselves in areas where they can safely do so. They are actively working with other organizations that do similar work to say, you know, hey, have you seen so-and-so? We haven't been able to track them down yet. Have they maybe come by your facility? Have you been able to reach them? Just trying to find answers. But it's difficult with such a transient community to really know where people went, where people were when the storm hit.
The stress that people are living through in these various mountain communities is extreme. And Dr. Richard Zenn, who is the chief medical officer at Via Health, which serves the western part of the state, says that while water, power, and roads are a primary concern, mental health needs to be taken seriously now. And he is encouraging people to reach out to others.
If you have family or friends or have folks in your community that may be isolated, now is a good time to reach out and help them, even with practical matters, getting them food and water and supplies, taking them to medical appointments, which may be a really helpful thing right now, given the transportation has been so hard.
When these disasters happen, they commandeer the headlines, and they're the only story you hear about on this show, on the evening news, on all the cable news networks. And then suddenly something else comes along and these stories disappear, while these folks who are struggling with recovery are still struggling with recovery and will be for a long time to come. Has anybody talked yet about how they will continue to get help and be supported when they aren't the top story any longer?
I think that definitely is a concern for people in the community, especially as their needs change. There's always this initial surge, not just of attention, but of charitable donations, of things that people need initially, but the needs are going to evolve over time. And I think these communities are just really hoping right now that people will stick with them and continue to support them. You know, the long-term economic impact of this is going to be massive. So many businesses destroyed at a time of year that is just huge for these economies in Western Yep. North Carolina. Fall and winter are just crazy important times for those local economies that are often so reliant on tourism dollars. And you've just seen so much of what drives that washed away, literally. Right. So, you know, it's going to take a long time to get those economies back online, and these people are going to need support for an extended period of time.
From Mary to Mary.
Yes, I was going to reiterate what she said about the economic impact. The whole community and the surrounding communities, so much of their whole value and how they see themselves is as a tourism destination, a place where people come to. A friend of mine, she was going to a wedding in Asheville, of course, that was canceled. Dinner reservations in Chimney Rock. That's our go-to. My husband and I, we love to go up there to the mountains, and you know, that's so much money for them and so much a part of their profile. And as you say, this might be generations. So how are they going to restore that? Yeah. And also the economic impact, obviously, the restaurants, the hotels and all of these things. Christmas at the Grove Park Inn, you know, all of these things that we know of that's such a part of Western North Carolina. What is going to happen?
All of this is going on, and we are just 25 days away from Election Day. Early voting has started. Mail-in ballots have already gone out and have started coming back in many areas. Steve, what's being done in these areas for those who want to vote despite all of their other troubles? How are they going to vote?
So the Board of Elections, they said this week that all of the county elections boards in the impacted areas are now open. Like you said, Mike, early in-person voting begins on October 17th. That's Thursday. There are about 10 early voting sites that, as of earlier in this week, are unusable. So people there will be voting in tents or trailers. The state has done this before out east after hurricanes. There are places like Avery County, I read, that have 19 polling places for Election Day. 14 as of now are unusable. So it's going to be a challenge. There will be places for people to vote in all of the counties. The state has made some allowances. For instance, if you vote by mail, you can return your mail ballot to a county elections board at a different county. You know, let's say you've moved, you can drop it off somewhere else.
Let's talk about some of the other changes that they've made for those folks in the mountains at the election board, and more about voting in the mountains when we come back. Also, we'll talk about the mis and disinformation and that's floating around the country about these efforts and what that's doing to folks who need the help. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. Steve Harrison's with us, our political reporter at WFAE News, Mary C. Curtis with RollCall.com, Alexandria Sands with Axios Charlotte, and Mary Ramsey with the Charlotte Observer. We were talking about how people in the mountains are going to vote and some of the machinations on the part of the elections board to help them do that. Karen Brinson-Bell, who's the elections director, says she is not seeking to reinstate the three-day grace period for mail-in ballots to be counted. The General Assembly requires that all mail-in ballots be received by 7:30 p.m. on Election Day. Why not extend that in these certain zip codes that were so dramatically affected, Steve?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, one reason is that would require approval of the General Assembly, and Republican lawmakers have made that a kind of a priority. I don't think they want to go back on that. Karen Brinson-Bell, even in the immediate aftermath of the storm, was saying that it didn't sound like she was going to be asking for that allowance. One thing that she had that she had talked about was allowing people to drop off completed mail ballots at Election Day polling places. That was something she had floated. That is also not happening. So if you look at kind of the changes that were made in totality, there weren't a lot of changes to the rules about how we will vote. It is mostly just the state board kind of scrambling to set up, like I said, tents and trailers and make it so people can vote.
Buncombe County is a blue county. That's the home of Asheville. But a lot of these stricken areas vote red. They vote Republican. Might this impact the outcome of this election in North Carolina, either at the state level or at the federal level? Will it make North Carolina more of a player in the Electoral College count or less of a player?
In elections that are this tight, and North Carolina is always tight, it just might, because it's not just the fact that, you know, it's more difficult to vote, but a lot of folks who are putting priority on recovering, will they even bother to vote? Will this be a priority? And we see that all but two of the counties did go fairly heavily for Donald Trump, and just two, the home of App State and Boone and Asheville, went for Joe Biden. So I think this is something we can't know right now, but the margin of victory for Trump in 2020, this was his slimmest. So the difference of, and we see he won, what, Georgia by 11,000 votes, we know that. So a little bit of a change could affect it. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I looked at the 15 counties impacted most by the storm. And like Mary said, Biden won two of them, Buncombe and Watauga. Trump won, if you held the election just within those 15 counties, Trump won by 57,000 votes. So let's say turnout is down 10% across the board. That could cost President Trump 6,000 votes. You know, in the 2020 election, Trump won by about 73,000 in North Carolina. But like Mary said, you had Georgia at 10,000. You had Arizona by 11,000. This election is so close that even a small drop in turnout in the mountains, it could have a big, very big impact.
Mary Ramsey.
Yeah, just to tack on to Steve's point, I talked to a couple of political scientists about the same thing. And the one thing that they did mention is that, yes, the majority of these counties are red counties, but they have relatively small populations compared to the two counties that Joe Biden did win. So there is also a scenario where you could potentially see Democrats taking a little bit of a hit if there's especially depressed turnout, say, in Asheville, where the Democrats traditionally pick up a lot more votes. If you've got, you know, a 10% drop in turnout in that county versus in one of the smaller counties, you're losing a lot more votes if you're a Democrat than the Republican would in those smaller counties. So, but at the same time, as Mary and Steve both pointed out, the majority of these are red counties. So it's definitely a concern, I think, for both.
Disaster and recovery should not be political, but like everything else in America today, it has become political. Donald Trump and his minions continue to spread lies. Let's call them what they are. About how the recovery is being handled, about FEMA seizing property. Mary already mentioned this, about FEMA not having the money it needs because allegedly the Biden administration has used that money to pay for illegal immigrants, about Biden and Roy Cooper not helping red-hit areas by the hurricane because they're red, not blue, every single bit of which is not true. It is a lie. And Republican officials who have found it necessary to work with the administration have corroborated the fact that they are getting the help that they need. And this past weekend, North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis on CBS's Face the Nation pushed back on the idea that the federal government wasn't doing enough to help Western North Carolina.
We can have a discussion about the failure of this administration's border policies and the billions of dollars it's costing. But right now, not yet, is it affecting the flow of resources to Western North Carolina.
And as this misinformation has spread, Governor Cooper warned people to be aware of the widespread nature of false information being spread by nefarious actors, both foreign and domestic.
I strongly urge people to verify with respected news sources the information and the videos that have been sent to you. Ask questions. Don't hesitate to ask for assistance from FEMA or from state responders.
and that disinformation extends to how to vote in this election if you've been affected by the hurricane. And right after the state elections board unanimously approved changes designed to make it easier to vote in 13 counties impacted by Helene, the executive director of the elections board, Karen Brinson Bell, was hot under the collar.
What a disgrace for anyone to try to provide misinformation or disinformation affecting their ability to vote. And one of the things that has been said is that we are doing our actions in some sort of partisan manner. And I hope that it is very clear to everyone today that that state board acted in a nonpartisan manner. I, as executive director, act in a nonpartisan manner.
We know this has been floating around. We know it's coming from Donald Trump and other Republicans. We know that it's coming from Russia. We know that it's coming from Iran, because the Homeland Security Department has informed us that a lot of this propaganda is designed exclusively to disrupt the election here in America. However, if you are a person with no cell service and no power, are you hearing that disinformation, Steve?
I assume, you know, you may not be hearing it directly, but you may be talking to neighbors and friends who are talking to neighbors and friends who do have cell service and internet, and it becomes kind of a giant game of telephone. People are under tremendous stress. Their lives are really hard. Their lives have been upended. And so, you know, people do latch on to things. And like I said earlier, a giant game of telephone, things get really twisted.
FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell says her agency is reaching out to communities whose primary language is not English to combat this disinformation.
Yesterday, when I was in North Carolina, we had one of our Spanish-speaking personnel that was there specifically to make sure he was doing the outreach and the engagement face-to-face in the communities to help them understand what resources and programs are available to them to help counter some of the misinformation that's out there.
And earlier this week, we spoke to Canton, North Carolina Mayor Zeb Smathers. And when we talked on this program about mis and disinformation, he brought the impact of this into focus.
But here's what worries me. With misinformation, especially some of our elderly, more vulnerable members of society, when you start telling them, and with propaganda, you can't trust your locals, you know, there is disinformation, that's the setup before the scam. And that's what worries me, is as we have seen the heroes here, we have seen such bipartisanship, people just let that be our legacy. But we also know the wolves are coming that want to take advantage of people. And that's why we're telling people, ask for legitimacy, look for badges. You know, if not, look to a trusted source. But the misinformation is not just put out there. It's put out there for a reason, to divide, to question, and it's not appreciative. And it also scares people. Because there are so many sources here helping people, saving lives, rebuilding this place we call home.
The key phrase there, for me at least, was when he said, when you start hearing that you can't trust your locals, that is the setup for the scam. Keep that in the back of your mind on so many different levels. Mary Curtis, the Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, has been calling the response to this tragedy in the western part of the state abysmal during his campaign events, and he blames Governor Roy Cooper. Most other state Republicans, to their credit, have refrained from any criticism, but nationally, Trump is leading the band on this with help from Russia. We also know why Russia is up involved in this, but why does Donald Trump continue to lie about things that are easily refuted by all of us simply watching TV?
Because there are so many people who only believe the information coming at this point from Donald Trump.
But we can see it with our eyes.
I heard an impassioned plea. I saw it reported from a man who said his father-in-law needs help, needs food, and he's telling him to go to FEMA. But he's saying no, because they're just going to take my property. They're not going to do anything for me because Trump said so. And that's the only source he trusts. So, we have increasingly siloed pieces of information. And as a journalist, I look at all of them. And if you turn on, say, Fox News, sometimes the news you are getting, I wouldn't even call it news, is so distorted that if you have that on all day, you will believe these things.
Will this work in his favor? Will telling these lies work in his favor?
At this point, he has a base electorate. He is not going for getting new people or independents to vote for him. You see him doubling down on trying to get infrequent voters. And his message has increasingly been to target others. So he attacks, the ads are all about transgenders as villains. They're all about immigrants as pretty much vermin, savages. His son was talking about they have lower IQs, the murderers that come here, they have bad genes. This is pretty raw stuff, but this is what he wants to do. And for those people who want to be fearful of any change, this could work to drive it up. The polls are still very, very tight, including in North Carolina, where Mark Robinson is running far below Josh Stein.
And many of the talking points here are taken from the script used by Adolf Hitler. North Carolina and other swing states are being bombarded with Trump commercials accusing Kamala Harris of supporting taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners and stating even the liberal media was shocked. Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners and illegal aliens. Steve, I hate to say this, but there is some truth here. But there's also some misrepresentation. So what's the real story?
So, yeah, if you are a football fan in North Carolina or any swing state, I mean, this is the commercial you see, I mean, by far. This is the, by far the biggest commercial, Trump commercial in rotation right now. And it stems back to a 2019 survey that then-Senator Harris took for the ACLU when it was asking about should inmates, including migrants in federal detention, should they have access to health care and surgeries to transition to a different gender? She said yes. There had previously been some litigation on this in California when she was attorney general from inmates who wanted access to health care to go to a different gender. But anyway, but she had answered that question correctly. Trump brought it up in their first and only debate. And in the aftermath of that, you know, as Trump speaks, it was kind of part of this long-winded rant. And a lot of people in the media kind of didn't know what he was talking about, didn't think it was true. Time Magazine fact-checked Trump, said he was wrong. And then Time Magazine had to correct its own fact-check because of that. And so because of this, they've felt like, I think the Trump campaign feels like this is one of their best issues, their best closing arguments in this race.
I don't want to run out of time before we talk about this because of the likelihood that the town of Matthews is not going to get the Silver Line light rail train as part of their newly formulated transit plan. Matthews Mayor John Higdon recently called for a transit summit of all the players in the region, and that's caused some drama on Charlotte City Council. Alex, what's going on?
Yeah, there was sort of this awkward moment this week during the transportation committee meeting where Malcolm Graham asked the city manager if they were going to kind of like show up as a unit to this meeting and hear out the Matthews mayor and the Matthews officials about their qualms with the transit plan. And Marcus Jones, the city manager, was kind of like, I don't really know who we would be in this situation. It was just a large question mark. And I asked some council members if they were going to attend, and it seems like only three or four are going to go. So I don't know how productive that meeting is going to be next Saturday. I think that the hope was that they could maybe bring in the consultants who worked on the plan and had come up with this 40-40-20 spending breakdown, which had 40% for roads, 40% for rail, and possibly look at some other alternatives to that. But if they don't have the consultants there, if the city is not willing to provide any resources or expertise, I don't really know what more will be able to do just sitting around.
And there is some concern here that by not presenting a unified front on this issue, that it's going to not play well in Raleigh when they send whatever legislation they're going to send to Raleigh to ask for the 1 cent sales tax for transit. We've been kicking around these transit schemes or dreams for more than a decade now, Steve, and we seem to be all of a sudden rushing to get our ducks in the row. There's no time to talk. Let's just do it. If we have major dissent over the plan from Matthews, why not participate in a summit before you send the final document to Raleigh?
That's a really good question, Mike. The city's view is that we have taken a vote. The vast majority voted yes, so that the people who voted no, in this case Matthews, the city's view is they should just stop talking. They should go away. They've had their say, done. Now, I'm not saying that's a really understandable position, but that's how the city sees it.
And we have about 30 seconds here. There was also debate this week about the proposed express lanes on I-77 South. NCDOT representative made a presentation indicating that by adding 11 miles of toll roads, it would cost $3.7 billion. City doesn't really have a say in all of this. But Ed Driggs has said if we don't have a private company, it's going to take decades to build this. What is the timeline?
Well, they have to have a vote. The Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization, long name, is going to vote to move forward with this project. And if that's a no, then it's probably never going to happen.
Well, that's a disaster waiting to happen, isn't it? Meanwhile, some big names are coming to Bank of America Stadium for a concert to raise money for hurricane victims. Luke Combs, Eric Church, James Taylor, Sheryl Crow, Keith Urban. Yikes. Tickets went on sale for this October 26th concert yesterday. So if you want to go, you better get them now. Steve Harrison, Mary C. Curtis, Alexandria Sands, Mary Ramsey, thanks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.